Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus.
Well, we straighten a lot of things out. For instance, I'll be handling all the trades.
What do you mean?
There'll be no phone calls in the dugout.
What do you mean? That is not...
No.
That's not right. I'm handling the trades.
That isn't the way we say it,
I have the right to call you in the dugout.
And that's not the way it's going to be, George.
Well, you're damn right it isn't. If you don't like it, you're fired.
You haven't hired me yet.
Has there ever been a more complicated person in baseball than Billy Martin? Charming and brilliant, sensitive and prone to anger, Martin rose through a rough neighborhood in the Bay Area to the top of the sports world, but spent his adult life struggling to stay there. A consistently winning manager now recognized as an ahead-of-his-time tactician, Martin is best remembered for his many stints working for Yankees owner George Steinbrenner. But his legacy is far more complicated than the headlines of the 1970s Bronx Zoo, as New York Times journalist Bill Pennington demonstrates in the new biography, Billy Martin, Baseball's Flawed Genius. Bill Pennington, welcome to the Roundtable.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Ian.
You were a beat writer in a Billy Martin clubhouse soon after you started being around the Yankees. What was your relationship like with him?
I happened to get along with him pretty well. I was more or less terrified of him at first. It's funny, the first year that I was on the Yankee beat was 1985, and that year began with the manager was Yogi Berra. And, you know, I said, okay, I can handle this this sort of charged atmosphere, and it's very competitive with a lot of top writers, veteran writers. I said, Yogi Berra is, you know, a very easy guy to get along with and nice to everybody. And then 16 games into the season, Steinbrenner fired Yogi and hired Billy, and I was like, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this. But first time I introduced him, he said, okay, you know, kid, you know, I was like kid to him forever. You know, we're both getting a fresh start here. You know, some of these guys, these other writers have already made up their mind about me. We've been through our wars. Some of them, they don't like me. I don't like them, you know, but we're getting off fresh. And, you know, if you're straight with me, I'll be straight with you. And he was. I mean, it's not to say that he didn't, you know, yell at me and you know, all kinds of different things. He was sometimes a hard guy to get along with. But overall, I sort of enjoyed being around him and liked his company. You'd stay away from him late at night maybe, but I learned a lot of baseball in between.
And one time he threatened you in a bar fight where he couldn't remember what he was mad at you about?
Yeah, it was sort of a classic... Sort of a classic Billy misunderstanding. I mean, you can understand how some of these fisticuffs he got in, started. I mean, he actually wasn't even managing that year. He was a broadcaster. He was in between his fourth and fifth stint as the Yankees manager, and he thought I had written something that I hadn't. You know, like somebody told him, oh, Pennington wrote. It actually was something along the lines of like the Yankees were better off with him in the broadcast booth instead of in the dugout. And maybe somebody wrote that, but it wasn't me. But Billy was convinced it was me. So there was a rain out in Cleveland, and this is about when he heard this, and the whole Yankee circus, the entire players, coaches, writers, everybody was in this bar across the street from the stadium. Because a rain out is kind of like a snow day when you're in grade school, when you're on the baseball beat. It's a free night. But Billy was determined to have us step outside so we could settle our differences, and I kept telling him, you know, we don't have any differences. And so finally I left the bar to get away from him before this went any farther. But he was definitely had a hold of my hand at one point, like trying to lead me out. And the next day I went up to him, I said, I don't know what that was all about, but, you know, you misunderstood me and it wasn't me. And he kind of looked at me and he said, okay, well, I'm glad you came over. He says, you know what I'm going to do, though? He says, I can't remember what made me so mad at you, so instead I'm just going to forget about it.
Was he constantly apologizing for what happened the night before?
No, because things didn't happen that frequently. I mean, across 16 years as a manager and, almost as many as a player, things happened. But, you know, all told in that, you know, whatever, 40 years of public life, it's maybe, you know, I don't know, 40 incidences, something like that. I mean, or 50 or something. So you're talking about they didn't happen that often. And it's funny, they happened to other people, too. You know, other managers that were his contemporaries were just as hard drinking and just as irascible and unpredictable. I think it was... Tommy Lasorda said, the ex-Dodgers manager said, you know, a lot of us got in these kind of tussles and stuff. He says Billy was just better at finishing him. Maybe he's just better known because he's better at beating people up than we are.
Let's talk about how he kind of got that scrappy reputation. He was born and grew up in a single-family home with a very salty mom, and basically he was a tough from the beginning, right?
Yeah, well, it was a tough neighborhood. It was very interesting to go back there, and I spent, almost a week back there just hanging out with a lot of his grammar school chums are still alive, and both his sisters are alive, his brother's alive, his cousins who lived across the street from her alive. And they depicted a neighborhood that, and you can still see it in some ways. It's changed some, but, there was a park between his house and school, and everybody, all kinds of people hung out in the park, including, ne'er-do-wells. And you had to walk through this park to get there, although a lot of people walked around the park to avoid trouble, but that wasn't Billy's way of doing things. So he'd go through the park on the way to school, and somebody might challenge him, and so he'd get in a fight, and then he'd go to school, and he'd come back on the way home from school and walk through the park, and somebody else might challenge him, so he'd take care of that. And this was a way of life for a lot of them. And as his cousin Mario said to me, he says, but he, again, he had had some training as an amateur boxer, and he said, he just was really good at he didn't lose these fights. And he says, and once you get good at something, then a lot of other people want to come around and test themselves against you. And he said, that's sort of what happened to Billy.
One other aspect of that area where he grew up was that it gave him a front row to really learn baseball. He was around pros who were coming back to train, and it gave him, an advanced understanding of the game that would serve him when he became a player in the big leagues, of course, but also as a manager. Is that where it really started for him?
Yeah, no question. It's probably the fundamental, most important thing that happens to him in his young life is that he had, in addition to everything else, this big park, Kenny Park, had this full-size major league diamond that was kept in, immaculate condition by the town because it was a haven for all the Bay Area ball players who would come back in the off season, and the weather was still warm enough that they would train all through the winter. Well, this was the place that they all came, whether it was Ernie Lombardi, who's in the Hall of Fame, Augie Galan, was a great Dodgers player, Bill Rigney, who was a great New York Giants player, and many others. Just about everybody except the DiMaggio's were known to, Bay Area stars were known to train there. So, and Billy, from the time he's, six or seven, just is glued to these games and, becomes kind of the mascot of some of these guys. Asks him a million questions. As he gets older, he's allowed to play in the games when he's, a teenage. But he would follow them home. I mean, Augie Galan lived in the neighborhood. He would walk home with them and ask him a million questions about why you did this and, why do you choke up when you got two strikes and how do you hit the ball the other way and why are you throwing behind the runner in this situation? And then the next day, Galan would come out of his house to go work out at the park again, and who'd be, waiting outside but Billy Martin. And he'd walk with him to the place to ask him a million questions. So, and these guys, I talked to them. Some of them are still alive that I was able to talk to, and they described this sort of kid who had no, didn't have much at all, had basically like two pairs of clothes, but had an insatiable desire to sort of make baseball his career. He just didn't want to play baseball. He wanted to be a baseball, career baseball guy. And they're very aware of that even when he was young.
We're speaking with Bill Pennington, the author of the new biography, Billy Martin, Baseball's Flawed Genius. Okay, so let's fast forward in the story a bit and talk about some of the innovations he did bring to game management of Major League Baseball.
Well, he introduced some tenets of what we now call Moneyball, which is popularized by the Oakland A's and the book and the movie. But it was slightly different. He didn't have all the sabermetrics and analytics. He didn't have a computer to work with, but he did know that what mattered was on-base percentage and scoring runs, and it didn't matter how you did it. And you didn't need home runs. You didn't need doubles. But you did need people that produced runs. So he would put an emphasis right away on getting on base, advancing while you were on base, and then most of all, putting an incredible amount of pressure on the other team's defense. That was the key, was to make them be constantly worried about you and therefore they will, be distracted by their own efforts to sort of play good defense. The infielders would be jumpy. So Billy would do things that just are unheard of. I mean, he would have a triple steal. I mean, you know, bases loaded, all three runners go. I mean, the point is to cause so much chaos that you'll get a run out of it one way or the other. Even if the guy's out at home, they'll start throwing the ball around. And it did work. And I don't, you know, I mean, when have you ever seen a triple steal unless it's a, you know, by accident in a little league game? So, I mean, he did that. He had some innovative thoughts on how to position the infield and the outfield. He did defensive, you know, something similar to what we now see in defensive shifts. A lot of bunting, a lot of hit and run, suicide squeeze he thought was a highly underutilized weapon. And I agree with him. You hardly ever see that in the majors anymore either. And I don't really know why. And it's interesting, one of the few people you do see it do is Buck Showalter in Baltimore, who was a Billy protege. He's had some very, he just thought that the biggest thing of all was to cause sort of chaos in the minds of your opponents and put a lot of pressure on them, and that was his that was the main calling card of his managerial style.
Here in New York, obviously, we think of Billy Martin as a Yankee and pretty much a Yankee only. He had been traded during his playing career after the Copa incident, of course, and managed a bunch of other teams. I wonder how the other franchises he's associated with look at Billy Martin's legacy and how he felt about the time he was away from New York.
Well, as a manager, when he came through those places, he's beloved and still is. Each time he got fired or pushed out, his first job was in Minnesota. When he lost that job, even though they won their division, he was the AO manager of the year. He got fired at the end of the year, and they were practically rioting in the streets. People were so upset. They hung the owner in effigy outside the ballpark. There was no sports talk radio then, but where they could protest, they did. He goes to Detroit, again leads them to the American League Championship Series, ends up having a falling out there too. Same sort of reaction, just picketing outside the ballpark. Everybody was, all the fans were really upset in Detroit, so he's beloved there. He's beloved in Minnesota now and then, and same thing happened in Texas, where he took the average attendance from 2,100 to 33,000. And then in Oakland, the same thing, where the turnaround might have been the greatest of all. They were just hardly a major league team, and he got them into the playoffs. So he's beloved in those places, and he played in a number of other cities those appearances were less memorable. Once he left the Yankees as a player, he didn't seem to ever be the same player. There's a variety of things. He was getting older. He had some injuries, but I think mostly his spirit was broken. You know, a Yankee is all he ever wanted to be as a player, and when he went to the other teams, it just wasn't the same for him.
Now, a huge part of it is the personal side. What makes him so fascinating was he was a genius on the field, but also so self-destructive off the field. You were able to talk to some of his ex-wives, and he had four of them who hadn't spoken about Billy Martin before publicly, and his children and so on. I kind of wonder how you place the alcoholism and the cheating in context here, because, it is a sad part of the story, and anyone who remembers the way he died knows that it had a very sad ending.
Yeah, there's some things that are somewhat unexplainable about Billy. He had these paradoxes. There's no other way to look at it. I mean, they don't really add up. He thought loyalty was the most important thing, probably the most important thing of any of our traits. And he was extremely loyal to his friends and to his players. I mean, he even got him in trouble a lot. He often got fired, or at least once got fired, because he was kind of just hanging on to players that he probably shouldn't have been so attached to. And yet, he could not be a loyal husband to any of his four wives. So it's hard to sort of all put that all together. I spent 500 pages writing about it. I spent almost 3 years of my life talking to people about it. And I think about him and almost all of them that were really close to him, including his son or, his sisters, they would shake their heads too. I mean, that there were certain things that really weren't that explainable. I mean, he that's what makes him sort of this, hard to figure guy. And it's interesting because while all of that's true, all four of his wives, and you're right, that the last one, Jill, hadn't spoke to anybody in 25 years. All four of his wives had very fond memories of Billy, very nice things to say about him, which isn't, you know, think about that. That's, you know, you know, they don't, you know, they accept that he did things wrong, but they don't consider the marriage as a mistake or something that that they shouldn't have done. And they as I said, they have very fond memories of him. So he accomplished a lot even while he was, as you said, you know, sort of bringing himself down frequently. He would often, you know, he's like a character in a play, you know, or a, you know, a Greek tragedy or something. I mean, you know, he has all these strengths and he can do all of these things, but then he's always undone by something, and it's usually, you know, really his strengths become his weaknesses almost. You know, I mean, the pushing and the determination and the you know, that he had so much usually wore people out.
There's a case to be made that Billy Martin should be in the Hall of Fame as a manager. He has, as you've demonstrated, a higher winning percentage than plenty of managers who are in and turned around a bunch of teams. Do you think his candidacy has been hurt by the fact that he's not around to kind of remind these veterans committees who meet every so often that he, you know, he maybe belongs there?
Well, certainly. And, you know, he didn't get, there's a couple of things that worked against him. He didn't get a chance to live into an older statesman sort of baseball, where I'm sure he would have had to calm down at some point and sort of, you know, let his image be rehabilitated a little bit. And when I say image, I mean, you know, the off the field fracases and the barroom brawls and that kind of stuff. And also, he never managed in the era of where there was wild card playoff teams in baseball, which kept him out of many, many opportunities to get into the postseason. You know, if there had been wild card teams when he was managing, six more of his 16 teams, he took five of his 16 teams to the playoffs, six more would have gone in the playoffs. So that's six more chances to win another World Series. You almost have to believe, though, some of those are pretty talented, really good teams that won like 97 games but didn't go to the playoffs. It's a good chance he would have won another World Series. If he has two World Series championships instead of one, his candidacy gets ramped up right there. But people are at this point, Tony La Russa, Bobby Cox, these guys are both in the Hall of Fame. Earl Weaver wanted to help until he died recently. And they are sort of putting themselves in charge of trying to get Billy into the Hall of Fame and have a better chance of getting in. I think there's a variety of things, including this book, that might help that cause.
A lot of our listeners are probably familiar with your work in the New York Times in the On Par coverage, and I just wanted to ask you how your golf game's going too.
Well, I'll tell you what. In the middle of this book, when I was spending all my like weekends and vacation days, chasing down another person to talk to about Billy or writing some of this, my handicap must have gone up three or four strokes. So Billy Martin was not good for my golf game. But now that it's over, I'm happy to say, the handicap's coming back down. So it was worth it. But boy, there were some summers when I did get out there and play a little bit, and I said, Billy, you're killing me. Billy, you are killing my golf game here.
Bill Pennington is the author of Billy Martin, Baseball's Flawed Genius, and a reporter for the New York Times. Bill, it's just been a pleasure to speak with you. I love your writing, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, it was funny.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.